VOA News, I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence will head a high-level delegation to Turkey to press that country's president to halt his invasion of northeast Syria. VOA senior White House correspondent Steve Herman reports.
U.S. President Donald Trump says the vice president will be accompanied by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and the delegation will meet on Thursday with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to press for a ceasefire. U.S. forces in Syria are being bracketed between Turkish and Syrian forces, and Trump is reiterating he wants the American military out of the way.
They're policing. They're not a police force. They're a different kind of a force. We want to bring our soldiers back home.
The Turkish president, meanwhile, is saying he told Trump he will never agree to a ceasefire and threatened American sanctions will not change his mind. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is defying a House subpoena for documents related to his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden, a potential Trump rival in next year's presidential election. Giuliani was deeply involved in pressuring Ukraine to open a corruption probe into Democratic presidential candidate Biden and his son Hunter. The Trump-Ukraine scandal was set off when an intelligence whistleblower expressed concern to the inspector general about Trump's July telephone call with Ukraine's president seeking a favor to investigate the Bidens. House investigators also want to know if Trump would release $400 million in badly needed U.S. aid to Ukraine if Ukraine would cooperate in a Biden investigation. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. 12 U.S. Democratic presidential candidates squared off in a spirited debate Tuesday night, all looking to confront President Trump in the 2020 election. Former Vice President Joe Biden, one of Trump's top challengers, criticized President Trump's policy on Syria, citing the withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria.
I would not have withdrawn the troops, and I would not have drawn the additional 1,000 troops here in Iraq, which are in retreat now, being fired on by Assad's people, and the President of the United States saying, if those ISIS folks escape from the prisons they're in, they'll only go to Europe and won't affect us. It has been the most shameful thing that any president has done in modern history.
The dozen challengers all support the four-week-old impeachment probe, although President Trump's removal through the impeachment process remains an unlikely outcome. In his opening statement, the former Vice President Biden, one of Trump's top challengers, declared Trump is the most corrupt in all of history, an assessment echoed across the debate stage. Facebook leader Mark Zuckerberg is defending meetings he reportedly had with conservative leaders after the hashtag Delete Facebook began trending on social media. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Politico reported this week that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg held private meetings with, among others, Tucker Carlson of Fox News and conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt. But there are also conservatives that have long accused Facebook of suppressing their political views. Zuckerberg says he meets with lots of people across the spectrum on lots of different issues and suggests others do the same. The social media giant has battled allegations since the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election that it's not doing enough to stop bogus accounts and political ads on its platform. I'm Shelley Adler.
U.S. basketball superstar LeBron James and his Los Angeles Laker teammates are back here in the U.S. following a strange week-long tour of China that had political overtures. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
While LeBron James and his teammates were on a plane to China, the general manager of the Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey, sent out a tweet. He supported pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong.
I believe he was either misinformed or not really educated on the situation.
James says Morey did not understand the potential consequences.
We all do have freedom of speech, but at times there are ramifications for the negative that can happen. When you're not thinking about others, and you're only thinking about yourself.
The Lakers spent their week in China in public silence.
So many people could have been harmed, not only financially, but physically, emotionally, spiritually. So just be careful what we tweet and we say.
In Hong Kong, protesters burned and stomped on LeBron James jerseys during a rally. I'm Ed Donahue.
And from here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian police used tear gas on Tuesday to disperse public school students demonstrating to demand their teachers' pay.
Surely exaggerates the police response, because in spite of all of the stone throwing and all of that, the police really use minimum force, because we have always asked the police to be reticent in how they handle our citizens.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. Guinean opposition and civil society groups plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a likely third term for President Alpha Conde. Thousands face evictions as Kenya's bid to save Mau Forest intensifies. And Zimbabwe's finance minister says the country's economy is facing temporary problems.
The economy is reforming quite fast, and these reforms are largely positive. We are setting the economy up for a very bright future and prosperity towards Vision 2030.
Umtule Mumbe is Zimbabwe's finance minister, and we'll speak with the author of a new book, An Impossible Inheritance, Post-Colonial Psychiatry and the Work of Memory in West African Clinic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian police used tear gas Tuesday to disperse public school students who were demonstrating to demand their teachers' pay. Some students said their teachers have not been paid for 4 months. The Ministry of Finance says it had disbursed the September salaries of teachers at the Monrovia Consolidated School System. Liberia this year has experienced a number of protests from doctors and nurses to university professors in the wake of a struggling economy. Minister of Information Eugene Nambwe says the government is currently restructuring its pay system, which accounts for the delay. He also says the police used minimal force to disperse the students, despite the students throwing rocks at the police.
Some students, particularly from the Monrovia Consolidated School System, protested on the streets of Monrovia because they had thought that the government wasn't paying their teachers. But the reality of the situation is that of the about 1,200 teachers that MCSS has, over 900 of them were already paid and the rest were being paid. You know, the government is currently undergoing a pay restructure exercise. So there are some times that we have these processing issues. So all of the pay issues with the teachers, their teachers were being addressed. In fact, a vast majority, about over 900, were already paid, and there were 200 who had received partial payments. Now, the information did not filter down properly, and that caused the students to jump in the streets. But I can also tell you that we shouldn't exaggerate the police response, because in spite of all of the stone throwing and all of that, the police really use minimum force, because we have always asked the police to be reticent in how they handle our citizens.
But Mr. Minister, so is it true that the teachers have not been paid for 4 months?
It is not true. Actually, the entire payroll for teachers in Liberia is around 17,000 teachers. Out of the 17,000, we have about 1,200 that work for the MCSS. Now, out of that 1,200, 900 have already been paid. Why? Just over 200 were being paid. So I'm saying that the government has been very current compared to other sectors with teachers' pay. So we'll continue to give the information to the population, to the citizens, so that they understand that this process that we are undergoing is in the greater interest of the country, because we are harmonizing the pay structure and we are also making the budget to reflect our actual domestic and international revenue collection, so that the budget will be a fairly balanced budget without, you know, all of the inflationary tendencies that we have had in the past. So this is a program that we are working on with the IMF, because we want to enter a program that the IMF will support.
We had a similar situation like this at the University of Liberia and at William V. Stoutmore University. Now it has trickled down to public high school students and high school teachers. Is it a matter of economic generally, or is it just an adjustment of the structure?
Well, we do admit that we face a very stringent economic situation in the country. This is why these measures that have been taken, not just the harmonization of pay, but some of the austerity measures and some of the measures to have a budget that has integrity, these things are necessary for the country to pick up and regain economic growth. So yes, this sporadic issues of demonstration by some of the civil servants, including teachers and health workers, but the Ministry of Finance that is paying these people have been working time. And this process that has been undertaken right now, things are simmering down. Nobody can come to the United States government owing them 3 months. Those who are owed for August have been paid, and people are receiving their pay for last month. We are trying to bring all of the pay situation up to current. This is why it's ongoing, you know. So we have to do a little bit more as a government to inform the citizens, to explain to them that the process will have some teething problems.
Eugene Nabo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Guinean opposition political parties and civil society groups say they plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a possible third-term bid by President Alpha Condé. The opposition says the president is trying to engineer a third term after his current second and constitutionally mandated final term ends in 2020. Government spokesman Amara Sampare says President Condé will speak on the matter after the conclusion of a nationwide consultation. Sidya Touré, leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, says the police killed seven people during protests yesterday and Monday.
We have two killed today. We were told a rise to seven people was killed from yesterday to today. In the rallies in the town against his third mandate of Alpha Condé, was police people shoot some of our militants. As I say, we have seven people who died.
Let me say that we tried to speak to the Minister of Information. I think he said that the government has identified the Interior Minister to be the spokesperson. What exactly is the government saying?
I don't know, because we didn't hear nothing. We only say that they're going to send policemen to stop the manifestation. But we have a real problem here. We don't want a third mandate of Alpha Condé. This is the main problem we have. And if we want to have a situation going down, the only thing is to say the constitution says that you have two terms in the Guinean constitution. If you finish it, you know, you can go and somebody can have a term for presidency.
I know that the president has not said yet whether he wants a third term. What exactly you, the opposition, would like for the president? What would you want to hear him say?
He said it clearly when he was in New York. We have to prepare people because we are going to a referendum for the constitution. He said 1 month and a half ago when he was in New York. And you have people who is working for him here. We have a meeting maybe every week since a year. And the prime minister say clearly that the government agree that they are going to a new constitution. In Guinean constitution, if you change the constitution, like give the possibility to the president to have a third term. So this is very clear for us, you know. We only say, if you don't want no problem about it, we just have to say that, okay, well, will be no modification of a constitution, there will be no over-election about this question, and everybody will be free.
In terms of protests, what is next? Are you planning more protests?
We continue to protest tomorrow because now we have the bankers with us, we have the teachers, and I think tomorrow will be another day of protest. And maybe we'll take 1 or 2 days to let people go to market. You know, Guinea is a very poor country. During the 9 years of Alpha Condé, he didn't give any possibility to find work and just nothing. You know, in 9 years, we have no hospital, no university, 100 kilometers of road, no electricity, no water supply. So people have to go to market every time because there is no electricity. So we have to let them go to market maybe 1, 2 days before they start again.
Sidya Touré is the leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. VOA reached a government spokesman, Amara Sampare, but he said the government has designated the Interior Minister to handle all questions about the protests. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and then you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's finance minister, Mthuli Mbe, says the country's economy is facing temporary problems, and he is hopeful that the economy will bounce back from what he calls a transition state. Mbe is currently in Washington to attend this year's International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings. Mbe tells reporter Marvelous Nyawui of VOA Zimbabwe service that his delegation will hold a Zimbabwe roundtable today, Wednesday, with foreign investors to discuss the progress on Zimbabwe's economic reforms.
is I've come here to attend the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. These are the annual meetings, and we've come to discuss various things that affect the global economy, that affect our economies, and that also affect Zimbabwe. And we're going to have a Zimbabwe round table on Wednesday to discuss the progress on reforms on Zimbabwe.
Where is this round table going to be, and what are you hoping to achieve from the round table? Because we see the Zimbabwean economy is currently in free flow.
Well, the economy is reforming quite fast, actually. These reforms are largely positive. They are setting the economy up for a very bright future and prosperity towards Vision 2030. What we're facing is a temporary challenge, a transition period, while the currency is trying to find its feet. Remember, this currency is new. This Zimbabwe dollar is trying to find its feet. It will stabilize. We'll do everything we can as government to stabilize it.
Talking about the currency, a lot of people are really against the bond note and are actually pushing for you as Zimbabwe to go back to the US dollar. What's the situation regarding that?
Well, the bond note is our currency. It is part of the Zimbabwe dollar definition. So it's a currency that we ought to be proud of, we should make use of. There's no way that Zimbabwe can use US dollar in terms of a one-to-one exchange rate. That kind of exchange rate is detrimental to the economy. It cannot compete. It will lead to industrialization, which was already happening to our industry. So a weaker, more competitive currency is key. What should happen is that perhaps we should spend more time thinking about how to do wage adjustments, and we've done a lot already to make sure that purchasing power can be restored. Again, you can't do it in one shot. It is gradual. It takes time, but it will come right.
And you're here at a MEFME meeting. How important is MEFME for Zimbabwe?
MEFME is very important to where the host in Zimbabwe, the head office in Zimbabwe. It combines various governments, central banks. They come together, and its role is to become a platform for knowledge sharing on how to manage the fiscal side of things, how to manage monetary policy, how to manage the financial systems for the betterment of the African economies. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important to be here and to support what MEFME does, because they help us do our jobs better.
Is Zimbabwe ever going back to the US dollar? What's your view on that?
Oh, well, we've got our own currency. We are moving on to the Zimbabwe dollar, which we have adopted. Remember, on the US dollar, you're still free to hold it in your bank accounts. You're still free to hold it under your mattress if you so wish. So really it's about what currency you use for transacting within the economy. And it is Zimbabwe dollar. That's what you use for accounting as well.
Mthule Mumbe, Zimbabwe's finance minister, he spoke in Washington with reporter Marvelous Nyahuyi of VOA Zimbabwe Service. A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, shows that a high number of children are suffering the consequences of poor diets. Issued ahead of World Food Day today, Wednesday, the report says that at least one in three children under 5 or 200 million are either undernourished or overweight. Mavis Ocheri has details from Washington.
The report indicates that almost 2 in 3 children between 6 months and 2 years of age do not eat food that supports their rapidly growing bodies and brains. Juan Maggi is the UNICEF Regional Nutrition Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa. She says 340 million children in the world suffer from deficiencies in essential vitamins and nutrients such as vitamin A and iron. She says this puts them at risks of poor brain development, learning difficulties, low immunity, infection, and in many cases, death. She says in Eastern and Southern Africa, Rwanda is the first country that has scaled up efforts on providing micronutrients powder to improve the diet of all children aged between 6 to 23 months.
In the same region, we have countries such as Rwanda, Tanzania, Kenya, and Ethiopia, where we are starting to see a gradual decline in stunting, and that can be influenced by just economic growth within the country, scaled up interventions at community level that are addressing malnutrition and attempts to improve the diets of children.
She says that millions of children in Africa are eating too little of what they need, and millions are eating too much of what they do not need. That means nearly 2 in every 5 children who are not growing as they should. Maggi says in all the regions, you UNICEF works in, Africa is the only one where stunting is not going down. She says this is partly due to the continent's rapidly growing population of children under age 5. She says out of 149 million children who are stunted or too short for their age in the world, 29 are in Eastern and Southern Africa. Correcting that situation is costly.
We also have data that shows that the cost of managing and helping a child to recover from severe acute malnutrition ranges from $110 to $150 for full recovery of that child.
A key element to addressing nutrition issues, Maggi says, is working with local government to train frontline health workers to manage care for children suffering from acute malnutrition or undernutrition. The care needs to be done through special nutrition centers. Maggi says, just as UNICEF is committed to meeting the challenges of undernutrition and hidden hunger, the organization must also work with government to respond to the new challenge of childhood obesity. She says that also threatens the well-being of children everywhere. For instance, she said governments should create policies that protect children from irresponsible marketing of unhealthy foods. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Tens of thousands face evictions as Kenya's government intensifies efforts to reclaim the Mau, East Africa's largest indigenous mountain forest and an important source of water for the region. Rael Ombo reports.
42-year-old Josephat Langat rummages through the remains of what was once his business in Sierra Leone, a town in Kenya's Mau Forest. He says a truckload of police arrived one early morning and forced residents to tear down their homes and businesses. He says the land they occupied was legally bought.
We bought. Most of us, we came from Kericho, Nakuru, all over the country. Reaching here, we have been cultivating up to 205. They came here, they told us, this land, you are living here illegally. Then we wondered, how can you say we are living illegally, yet we have documents?
Kenya began evicting people from the forest last year to protect its fragile ecosystem. In August, the government announced plans to evict another 60,000 people from the forest. Rights group like Human Rights Watch says authorities should provide residents with adequate notice and compensation and ensure that police officials do not use unlawful force in removing settlements. Otieno Namwaya is a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch is not saying that conservation should not happen. We actually hold the view that conservation is very important and the environment needs to be conserved. However, we are saying that government can still do conservation legally and in a manner that respects human rights.
In a recent report, Rights Group documented 9 deaths that took place during the July 2018 eviction process. The block where the current evictions are taking place is Masai Mau, managed by the county government of Narok and government-run Kenya Forest Service. Appearing before a parliamentary committee probing the evictions, Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for the Environment, Keriako Tobiko, defended the government's move to protect the forest.
Even if, for argument's sake, Masai Mau were not still trust land under the county government of Narok, if there are processes and activities that destroy the environment, the ecological value of that asset, the national government has the responsibility to come in to eliminate processes and activities that are likely to endanger the environment.
Encroachments into the forest are affecting livelihoods further away. Rainfall patterns have become unpredictable, and the Mara River, whose source is in the Mau, has become polluted and receded significantly, says environmental lawyer Kitipa Naikumi.
In the process of keeping the people in the Mau, we are probably wiping a whole generation downstream in the Masa, within the Mara ecosystem. And so, well, the balancing of rights, the right to a humane process of leaving the Mau, and the right for the people who live downstream.
As for Josephat Langat and other evictees, they say they hope they will get justice from a government they say betrayed them. Rael Umbur for VOA News, Narok, Kenya.
This week, anthropologist Katie Kilroy Marak is in Dakar to speak about her book, An Impossible Inheritance, Postcolonial Psychiatry and the Work of a Memory in West African Clinic. The book tells the story of a distinctive project in transcultural psychiatry that was initiated at the Fan Psychiatry Clinic in Dakar during the 1960s and 1970s. Kilroy Marak spoke to Ricky Stryak about the issues addressed in the book and how they persist today.
A lot of what he did kind of revolved around the concept of culture related to local, so Wolof and Lebu, but even Serer, ceremonies, ways of thinking about mental illness and healing. And so he was really, really interested in culture. Culture was really at the center of his project. This group was a mostly, you know, they tried to be as eclectic as possible, but within the clinic, the doctors were mostly French, right? He did also train the first generation of Senegalese psychiatrists. When he finally left in 1978 to go back to France, the Senegalese psychiatrists who took over really distanced themselves from the project that he had set up and had run all those years that focused on culture.
Why?
Puzzles that I kind of look at is, I mean, something that on first glance seems kind of counterintuitive, right? That the Senegalese psychiatrists take over and they distance themselves from the culture project. In some ways, this culture project was a project that was associated with a kind of colonial or neo-colonial regime.
Is there a refocus now toward these methods?
I think there still is a tension toward what's happening in a family and how family relations can be at the source of conflict that can make problems much worse for people. And yet they're also still amongst the doctors working in the clinic is this idea that psychiatric problems exist in the brain, right? They don't originate in social relationships. They originate in the brain, and social relationships can make them worse.
And it's kind of antithesis to the way a lot of traditional systems approach mental health.
Exactly. And so if a patient comes to FAN now, a patient is put on medication, you know, there are pinch ceremonies, there is art therapy. Of course, really, it's only men who go to art therapy, not women. There are some crafts that social workers try to get the women engaged in, you know, kind of occupational therapy stuff. People are staying there, they're kind of being monitored. And the idea is taking a little bit of time out of their lives and then taking this medication, they'll be able to reintegrate themselves into their daily normal, which is kind of the goal, right? To be able to go back to where you came from and be functioning well. So I had one nurse, for example, tell me not too long ago, you know, when we come in, we often see that the patient is in conflict with his or her family. And we see that as a sign that the patient is sick, a sign that the patient isn't well. And so as the patient takes medication and stays at the clinic, we see those relationships improve, and that tells us that the patient is getting better. That's a very different thing than looking at family relationships as a possible source of malaise or of suffering.
That was Katie Kilroy-Marak, an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Liberian police used tear gas on Tuesday to disperse public school students who were demonstrating to demand their teachers' pay. Some students said their teachers have not been paid for 4 months. The Ministry of Finance says it has disbursed the September salaries of the teachers at the Monrovia Consolidated School System. Minister of Information Eugene Nambwe says the government is currently restructuring its pay system, which accounts for the delay. Guinean opposition political parties and civil society groups say they plan more protests today, Wednesday, against a possible third-term bid by President Alpha Condé. That's it for this Wednesday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.